A friend offers to take you to a place that you've never been. You're ready to go, and you're pretty sure you're going to find something there of interest. But when you walk in the door, what you see changes your life forever. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I'm Krissa Hewitt, and Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program produced here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Today, co-host Stephen DeLuque and I begin a two-part program with a visit with Bob Nichols. Bob is a local artist who has been in this county since the mid-60s when he came here to go to Cal Poly. During the 70s and most of the 80s, Bob made his living as a potter. For those of us lucky enough to be around in that era, many of our houses are highly decorated with wonderful dinnerware, beautiful vases, and incredible lidded jars. The rich earth-tone glazes were certainly inspired by trips to Utah and Colorado, and the well-designed forms were inspired by Bob. He has since moved on to teaching at Allen Hancock, where he has been for over 20 years. But it's a lot more fun to hear him tell this story. And what I can affirm without any hesitation is that he has certainly left his mark here on the Central Coast. Here now is Bob Nichols. Good afternoon, Bob.
Hello. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Hello, Bob.
And this is part of the series that we haven't given a title to yet.
I think I came up with the term of luminaries.
I think you did, and then
yes.
I forgot it. Okay. We're proceeding with our group of luminaries, people that we feel in the arts have been very influential in a lot of different ways and have been at it a while. Bob, you certainly qualify on that count.
You know, when you called and said we'd like to sit down, I started reflecting into the scary kind of thing. I came to Cal Poly out of high school to study in the School of Architecture. I decided at age 13 that was my career path. And I'd taken one art class in high school, and that was because I figured if I was going to draw buildings, I needed to figure out how to draw trees. And that was about the extent of any preparation in the arts. During my second year at Poly, one of my classmates showed up with a remarkable ring. And I turned to John and said, "Where did you buy that ring?" And John's response was, "Of course, I made it. And after class, I'll take you to where they do that." And that was in Engineering West, where the crafts lab was much earlier. Went in the back door, and I lost track of John because up against the wall were eight potter's wheels, each with a student at work. And I was dumbfounded, absolutely stood there with my chin on my chest staring, and finally said, "I've got to do this. Where's the teacher?" And someone pointed in the direction, and I went over and introduced myself to Roger Bailey and explained. And he said, "Well, the seniors will take the pottery class, but if you sign up for advanced crafts, I'll let you work at the potter's wheel." And in 2 weeks, I was enrolled in my first ceramics attempt. I made my first piece of pottery 1 hour before the start of my first class and effectively never left.
And what year was that?
That was in 1967. And by the end of that spring quarter, I had a key to the lab, and my job was to come in and clean up for 2 hours every night. And I would come in and work for 4 hours on my own stuff and then clean up after myself for the 2 hours. By the end of the next year, I had the full-on lab tech job, which amounted to basically learning at everyone else's expense, mixing clay, mixing glazes, loading kilns, screwing things up.
And but, getting really well paid.
She jokes. I still had a key. that was the best pay at the time. And by the time I graduated in 1971, I had pretty well determined that although I was going to walk out with a degree in architecture, my path at that point was to be a studio potter. And I had accumulated a list of 300 names of local community members who had bought my work. And so the only place that made any sense to do something as foolish as to try and be a self-employed potter was in San Luis Obispo. And very, very fortuitously, our neighbors pointed us in the direction to a house over here on Lawrence Drive. And it was a little tiny 900-square-foot California bungalow house. And that was transformed into a studio in the fall of 1971. And I had the most fortunate experience of a community that supported my work, my enthusiasm for clay, and my family for the better part of 20 years.
When you describe, and just watching your eyes light up, that walking in and seeing the potter's wheels, had you ever played with clay before?
I think once in the seventh grade, and I thought it was disgusting.
But when you walked into the Cal Poly room, were there people throwing?
Yes, yeah. There were eight folks at the wheel, and I had never seen that before.
Okay. Because, and I may have told this story on air before, going to the county fair in L.A., and I was probably seven, maybe six, and it was my first time seeing a potter's wheel. I was mesmerized, and pretty soon the person standing next to me wasn't my mother anymore. Never forgotten it. So back to your story.
After 2 years of working in the pottery lab at Cal Poly, one day my instructor came in and picked up one of my pieces and trimmed it as his own. And the message I took from that was, okay, it was time to move on. We were living over on the other side of town on Meineke in a rental unit, and one other of my colleagues and I decided to have our own studio. So we built our first kiln and jerry-rigged our natural gas pipe. And the most amusing thing about that kiln was that it was a very simple structure, and it was built under an enormous Monterey pine tree. And the next-door neighbor was a city fire marshal. And I can remember standing there firing the kiln and glancing up at him as he was staring down at me, waiting for the tree to burst into flame. We never had that problem, but that's small-town stuff that one encounters.
I think that was rather fortuitous to have a fireman right next door.
It might have been. When I graduated and we left that and found the house over here, by then I had begun to build relationships with other potters around the state, and one in particular, Tom Collins, who remains a good friend, but it was a graduate student down at Scripps College in Pomona. And so Tom was taking me places that I had never imagined. We were going to exhibitions, we were going to the studios of people in the Southern California area, and consequently I was beginning to gather a lot more technical information than I had been exposed to at Poly. And lots of times people say, well, wait a minute, you have a degree in architecture, but you never practiced architecture. And in a sense, my view has always been that it's true. I, other than the house that we're sitting in, never designed a building and saw it to construction. But the core of the Cal Poly architecture design program, in my opinion, is problem solving. And those sets of skills are applicable in many, many ways. It wasn't until my fourth year when I took a course called business practice that I fully began to understand what it meant to be an architect. And it was a lot different than designing and building things. It turns out that if anybody who was a successful designer rapidly had more work than they could accommodate, so they immediately had to hire other people to work in their firm, and those other people did all the interesting work, and the principal and the firm ended up very rapidly having to do nothing but chase jobs to keep the employees busy. In addition, an architect is always dependent on the level of skill of the contractors and builders that are involved. As a potter, if I didn't like a piece the way it turned out, I could sit right down and try again. And the immediacy of that really suited my selfishness. I didn't have to push others to make my dreams real. I could push myself.
I remember one time your description of the fun for you of opening a kiln, that each time you could have a sense of what would be there, but that there was always that element of something that maybe was happening that you couldn't totally predict. The pleasure of that learning curve, the pleasure of that experience?
The process is at the core of most studio work. and the experience of working with materials. So working with clay, what I have come to love is that every single day is an opportunity for new possibilities. And those new possibilities are based on past experience and past excitement. I can do everything that I know how to set in motion some expected results. And yet, when the kiln is unloaded, sometimes it's enormously disappointing. I've quit being a potter forever at least a dozen times in my career. It's just such enormous frustration over things not turning out well. On the other hand, I always tried to have some new experiment in almost every firing. Those experiments would yield new possibilities. There are these pieces that come from the kiln, and initially I was thrilled that anyone would trade money for this work. And it was really useful, food and mortgage payments and insurance and fuel to take the pottery to the Bay Area for the marketplace. But a piece occasionally would come out, and it always seemed that those pieces were some of the first that were sold. And I took a look around the house one day and realized that everything in the cupboards was chipped, cracked, broken, or less than satisfactory. And I thought, something's wrong here. And the wrong was I wasn't keeping the very best work at home. It might be just an intimate bowl, you know, two hands can wrap it up. But something happened during the firing, and I needed to keep those pieces as investments in the future. I'd put them in places where I had to walk past them a dozen times a day. I'd pick them up and study them. And as long as they kept teaching me about what's possible, then I would need to have them around. And at the point when I realized I had sort of mastered what I perceived I could learn from that piece, I tended to give them as gifts to folks that I know that I would maybe see the piece once a year. Mm-hmm. But that was a way of investing in the future potential of the work.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Our guest today is Bob Nichols, artist, potter, teacher, extraordinaire. We continue now with a conversation about the challenges for the artist of meeting the expectations of the buying public.
One of the horrifying aspects and the better parts is that when people are supporting an artistic endeavor, in this case my pottery, then they're always reacting to what they've seen. They're always asking for something like what they have seen. And I was really fortunate because I had grabbed some visual clues from Roger Bailey and Roger Marshall, two of my predecessors. They had some techniques, and so I stole their techniques, and I was using them and doing sort of modifications of that. And I realized at one point I could continue to make those same pieces for the rest of my life and make a living and be bored silly. And so I announced at some point, I'm going to stop making this particular line of work. And I think up until 2 years ago, about once a year, somebody would call and say, couldn't she just do that again? I haven't done those pieces for over 25 years, and yet it still flows almost automatically out of the muscle memory of that design technique. So it was a really good thing to stop because that forced the issue of growing with the work. Figuring out a strategy to stay alive with the work is at the core of personal energy. And one crosses one's fingers because will the community go with these transitions, these new looks, this new, and I had that good fortune.
I think as artists we have a difficulty in that oftentimes our audience will fall in love with a particular technique or style in which we're working, and they want to see you continue that ad infinitum. And as artists, I don't know about you, I get bored with it after a certain period of time. It's stopped teaching me anything about it, and so I want to try something else completely different and move on. And I'm like you, this people still call me up and say, you used to do this series of chickens, and I'd love to have a chicken painting. It's like, nope, that's flown the coop. We're through with that one completely and never coming back. But you do have that, especially when you're living in a small town and people have that memory of a series that you've done before. And breaking that pattern it's not difficult for the artist. I think it's difficult for the audience, you know, to see you grow into a different direction.
The balancing act is inevitably economic. Mm-hmm. At some point, if there's no market for the work has to change to meet the market, or the work has to change in terms of what one does to pay the rent, so to speak. Figuring out a way to grow and keep that fresh is a strategy that was, in a sense, subverted for me as I approached a period of time, 17 or 18 years in self-employment in studio practice. Real life things, terrible, painful divorce was part of that. And I ended up applying for a grant with the California Arts Council to be an artist in residence. I tried to be in San Luis Obispo. I couldn't find anyone to co-sponsor that. So I ended up in Santa Maria, where the Santa Maria City and Recreation Parks Department signed on, and my job was to create a pottery studio and teach 20 hours a week. I did that, and that was from 1985 through 88, and it completely transformed my experience, because one of the first things that happened, I'm with the head of the recreation department, we go to the facility and into this room, and I said, okay, where am I going to build the kiln? And he said, build a kiln, there's one in the corner. And that's all there was going to be, was this electric kiln, which is an entirely different set of issues, technically and aesthetically, than I had ever dealt with.
Bob had always been working with stoneware, which requires a gas kiln to fire to its maximum maturity. Faced with an electric kiln, he was going to have to switch to low-fire clays. These clay bodies take different glazes, fire at different temperatures, and thus it was going to create, in many ways, a whole new world.
So I just changed. I just said, okay, here's what we're going to do, and taught myself what was necessary to teach others how to use those materials. And by the time I received the call from the art department at Hancock at the end of that three-year cycle, the head of the art department showed up and said, Bill Shin is going to retire. We'd very much like you to come and teach. We can only offer you a part-time position. And I said, I think that will work fine with one exception. I want to rewrite the curriculum. So what had been completely a high-fire stoneware program started with not the potter's wheel, but in low-fire hand-building techniques for the Ceramics 1 class.
So that shift really started because of almost being forced in to deal with the low-fire technology and discovering just different ways that you could be approaching your work, plus being able to teach it? Did I get that right?
I think that's a perfectly fair statement. I didn't go down there thinking this is where I'm going with my work. And there are a couple of things that really began to unfold that I didn't expect. One of those was that when teaching extensively, the energy available for me in studio work diminished. Mm-hmm. All the people who had called over the years past, I used to do studio workshops. I would get an invitation. That became our vacation vehicle, Idaho, Montana, up and down California, Utah. And they would call and say, we'd like you to come do a weekend workshop and show us what you can do. And I'd say, I'm not so sure I want to spend my weekend doing what I just did all week. Mm-hmm. And so stop doing the studio workshops. So that was one change. The next change was I didn't have the time for my own work that I had lived in luxury. And it's still an unfulfilled part of my experience is the lack of doing my own work. I do my own work, but I used to measure my competence as I unloaded the kiln. Now that's a rare occurrence. And at 65, I also am discovering when I go in to do a whole lot of work, that the energy is different than I had at 30. Shocking, but
you think.
Yeah, it's very interesting to hear this because I have never made an attempt to be an artist who was dependent on my work to feed myself, clothe myself, house myself. And fortunately, really love teaching, so making that decision was not, this is all I can do kind of thing. But it did mean that for me, when I would come home, I was usually exhausted enough, and running down to my studio was not the first thing on the agenda. What has happened in that conversation over the years, conversation being mostly internal, has been that sense of, do I get to call myself an artist if I'm not in that studio every minute? And it's been a very interesting exploration and lately self-discovery of recognizing how many ways I use the problem solving, the creativity, but the teaching was also a creative endeavor. And my sense is that you give a lot in that classroom.
Krissa, when you retired from Poly, I assume, had a transforming and a gradual shift in your experience of the studio.
I was able to take the first year, which people often say you need a year to make some transition, to expand my studio. And the purpose of that was to enable me to bring in some more tools, but also so I could set up a student workspace. And that has been tremendously gratifying to have people coming to me. We don't have to have a curriculum agenda. We're just able to take it where it needs to go. And so that gets me down in the studio a lot. Sometimes I'm working alongside of them, and I have been doing more of my own work.
I'm intrigued with that from several points of view, because there's some point in the next couple of years I'm ready to step back from teaching full-time, and my intent is to reinvent myself as a studio artist. We'll see how that plays out. But I've had many super advanced students who are succumbed to the dream of having their own studio, and they prepare and they get everything all together, and then they discover how lonely it is, and pretty soon they're back taking classes. And I've had the good fortune of creating a curriculum that allows the really advanced students to be able to continue by creating a new class every semester for them. But it's intrigued me because I know that it was not an accident that I spent 20 years basically alone in the backyard. So now, usually by Tuesday evening, I'm kind of done socializing for the week, and I'm nowhere near finished. So it's always intrigued me that folks do all that preparatory work and then discover that they really like the social environment to work within. And it sounds like you've got kind of a mix going on there of having being accountable to some others is helping you get down into the studio, as well as the ongoing dialogue, that sharing aspect of the work. I was always so impressed that you were able to continue to produce while teaching full-time. Were those pieces that oftentimes started in the school studio as technical demonstrations that you then were able to complete on your own?
Very seldom, because for me, working in metal, the classroom just never was a very conducive spot to be able to do anything for any more than a few minutes at a time.
Okay.
I have a feeling all of a sudden this is a story about me, which is kind of interesting. But
yes, the interviewer has become the interviewee.
I love it.
Well, I asked that question out of the framework that through my teaching, particularly to these advanced students, I have learned that I feel a responsibility to continue to expose them to possibilities. And one of the ways to do that is to keep pushing myself to do my own work and things they haven't seen before, or to go out and study new techniques. So we've been able to do things like screen printing on clay, making ceramic decals for low-fire decorating techniques, working with plaster to make really comprehensive mold studies. And so, in a sense, I haven't allowed myself to stay right where I would perhaps be most comfortable, because I also feel the responsibility to make sure that they're aware of possibilities.
Absolutely. And one of the things that students have always done for me is, as they often in ignorance, because the metal material takes a long time to learn what you can do with it, start off with something that may be physically impossible. So then you try to say, okay, how can we tweak this so it's possible? A couple of the students are there as much just for the fun of the doing, but not worrying about the completing. They're just really process-oriented folk. And in doing that, it creates wonderful challenges. So waking up in the morning going, oh, I got it. I think I can introduce this idea. And that really feels fulfilling when you know that you've been able to assist somebody, but also got a new venue yourself. Or
you know. You just brought up a point that brought a whole series of thoughts to mind, and that is about the notion of process orientation. It seems to me that almost everyone that I've met who goes into the arts is seduced by some aspect of the product. They want to see an output of their efforts. They want to see a ring. They want to see a coffee cup. They want to see an image. And I've watched over the years the subtle but almost indisputable shift away from worrying oneself about what am I going to have at the end of this process and falling in love with the process itself. And the more one cares about the process, the more one invests in the process, guarantees quality at the end, but suddenly it becomes the piece fell down. It's just clay, you know, wedge it up, go again, as opposed to that heart-wrenching sense of loss.
It's funny that you mentioned that because I've recently started a series of paintings that are completely non-objective, and I've never worked in this focus before. And the series is called Lacerations of the Heart. And it is part of that, too. It's the fact that I have always enjoyed the process, and I've never placed much importance on the product. And so for me, it's like I keep paintings around for 4, possibly 5 years, and I get tired of looking at them, and I paint over them. And people are aghast that I do that. And it's like, well, I've learned what I've had to learn from that. You know, I've gone through that process, and this is the product, and now I want to learn something new.
That's a pretty good metaphor for life, I think. And I'm glancing over here some stuff that we just brought back from Mexico. And my wife keeps asking me why I'm gathering these hearts that have knives stuck in them and various kinds of notions. And to me, that's all about this, the basic journey of a lifetime, and involves many kinds of heartache and disappointment. And whether it's that kiln firing that was just horrifying, or a piece that has collapsed, or a relationship that didn't work out. We bring passion to our life experiences. Sometimes the flames get doused, sometimes they are enriched. But as artists, being engaged with material technique and process, and better yet, I think, ideas, then the output is an extension of this exploration of this other combination. It's no longer, how did it look? Well, the artist, in effect, always has to become his or her own critic. There will be many critics. Some of them will provide insights. Some of them will provide affirmation. But the real issue with the work is, how well does this fulfill my expectations? And how can I keep building? How can I keep working to move forward with the work, with life, with love, with passion?
Since I first met him in 1976, I have always been impressed with Bob's ability to articulate the difficult. You have been listening to a conversation with Bob Nichols, a local potter, ceramic artist, teacher, and as you will hear next week, a significant contributor to the local art scene. So we hope you'll visit us next Wednesday at 4:30 for part 2 of this conversation. This has been Ears on Art, produced here at KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. I'm Krista Hewitt. On behalf of co-host Stephen DeLuque, I want to thank you so much for listening.